Hi, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 26th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Karen Herseth Wee. Her session is entitled Tremors, Vibrations, Enough to Rearrange the World. Let's listen in.
My name is Karen Herseth Wee. And the title of this session, this poetry reading, is the title of this book. We have just come out with a new book, a group of women and I who write together, called Tremors, Vibrations, Enough to Rearrange the World. So I'm calling this a publication reading. This is rather hot off the press. It's filled with a lot of good work, and it was really fun to do. Even the piece of art on the front is a visual artist friend of mine who has done this, and David and I actually own the painting. So I'm going to start with poems that really introduce myself and tell you who I am, where I come from, why I write, something about those kinds of details. I'm kind of going to divide it into three sections. This first part that gives this ranch, rural background that I come from in South Dakota. The second part, which is the publication reading part, where I'll give you some snatches from some of the other people who write in this book, as well as my own. And then the third section, which I'm going to end with the kind of advocacy work that David and I do, because we are parents of a lesbian daughter. We have three children. Their ages are 34, 30, and 26, and their daughter, son, daughter, and our youngest is lesbian. So we've been on a very important journey educating ourselves about that, and I've been writing about it because I do write about the things that are of my heart. The first one I'm going to read tonight fits with the theme of water-washed, spirit-born, and it's called Torrent. And if you ever wonder if writing exercises work, this one for me was real proof. A friend and I were going to go deliberately, intentionally, to the cities to go to museums and parks and write poetry. The day we were going to go, it poured rain. It poured and poured and poured rain, so we never left our house. And we wondered how we were going to do this, and so we used a timer on the stove, and we wrote for 3 minutes about why this rain was good. I remember rain like this. And then when the timer went off, we'd switch it and say, I don't remember rain, and I don't remember when. And the piece I got, not born perfectly, was this piece about remembering rain. It's called Torrent. I remember rain like this when I was 25, an all-day trip to Cambridge, Rebecca 3, David searching for his dissertation advisor, who on a leave from Stanford writing on E.M. Forster had stumbled on some photos, then lost them, very rare. I remember waiting in a car all day and the rain coming down, Rebecca 3 and full of questions as the two of us stared out the sheeting windows at the old streets, sidewalks, spires, Cambridge in the distance. I remember gray, the buildings, the sky, even the red Volkswagen convertible from the inside. I remember waiting, David gone a long, long time. Twilight came. When I think back, he might not have returned. What then would we have done? Flown home? Were we there in 1965 just because he was? I remember rain like this another time. A house along a road in Minnesota, its red frame windows peeling paint. After 4 days of springtime rains, the lost septic tank underground groaned, turned over, and emptied itself up into our house. Asthmatic, David fled to his office in the dead of night to merely live. I don't remember rain like that much in between. In Cambridge, Rebecca had to pee. We did not know where we were, so I held her small self over the nearby curbstone gutter by our car and watched her yellow urine hurtle down a slanting road blended with the rain. Back in Northfield, the children headed to the woods to pee. Small toothbrushes, glasses of water clutched tight in their fists. Before school one morning, I found Allison on the lip of our southwest window well, proud in her comfort as she pooped in the yard. I don't remember how long my hair was in either instance, or how I was as woman, wife, or mom. No journals live to tell. In the first siege of pouring rain, I was not a writer. In the second siege, I was. I don't remember all of how this came about, but this is some. Those long Midwestern winter days, children in and out of doors, in and out of snowsuits, forts, and boots, so many times a day, always it seemed they had to pee. I would dress them down to skin, then dress them up again. In both instances, I was young. I didn't know it then. I know my father was alive in the first rain, gone in the second, like Barrett's husband in Giants in the Earth. He disappeared in the dead of winter. I know that young woman holding the girl above the gutter on the Cambridge street as pee streamed away to rain knew very little really about who she was in Cambridge, or why she had become the mother of that child, or what the price. Nor had she learned much 10 years later, though her dad had left the family and his life, and she had taken a job for a little money. She picked up a pencil and talked. I know David never found his academic advisor that day in Cambridge when I was 25. After hours of search, he returned to the car, and we all went dolefully home, the windshield wipers slashing. That's all I ever saw of Cambridge in my life. And I know we found the septic system. After days of search and authorities, even a husband-wife team with witching rods, we found the poison gas, forced it back into the ground. The kids have grown now far too old to hold over any gutter. I remember phone calls then, the magic feet of someone's voice whom you love flying over wires to yours, telling you something that changes you right where you stand like a godmother's wand. Like Mom's call that January saying Dad had fallen dead. A big man gone right to the floor, guest in a friend's kitchen. Mom snowbound at the ranch, cloistered in an upper bedroom with their shared history. No one could reach her for hours. When the state snowplows finally got through, she'd been glad that she could not be reached. Rebecca remembers me taking that call. The look on my face, the crying, how the snow came down, ice too, a sheet of glass that carried us to the last air flight out of Minneapolis for days. I don't remember how I felt about that call, as I remember waiting in the Volkswagen on the gray Cambridge street years before. I don't remember taking the kids to Ruth's, but I remember deciding to. I don't remember the details of my mother's long night of talking about her Buntrock family when we arrived for the funeral, but I remember that she told us, and told us. She could not stop telling us, not of Dad's life, but of hers. I wish to inform myself about that young woman lost in Cambridge with her child splay-legged over a gutter. I would like to talk with the somewhat older young mom of three who sent them into the forest, not with crumbs, but with toothbrushes and water instead, as the rains came pouring down. I want rain to pour when it is needed like tears, but to stay in the heavens when corn is already as tall as the sky. I want rain for cleanness, but not for drowning. Rain to make distance easier on eyes with little pigment in them, but not for endless days of flood. I want a bridge from the Volkswagen in Cambridge over the child, the death, the reluctant septic system, the woman who could not be reached, the other one who cannot remember, over the torrent that has been transforming ever since. And then just the other day, I went to Ingrid Chris Johnson's class, where she asked us to write for 12 minutes. And one of the wonderful things about writing, which I urge you all to do, is someone just needs to say, ready, set, go, and give you an idea, and something will happen. This one is called Fencing, and it's just been written down. My bones know this place, working barehanded with the barbed wire strands. I recognize this as the most familiar to me of all places on earth. Travel around the globe in the last half year does not diminish the uniqueness of this spare prairie. I know it, this piece of ground, from eons ago in another life. I had returned to South Dakota to spend just 4 days with my brother Lars on the land where we had been born. A year and a half before, our mother had died, which knitted him, my sister, and me closer together than we ever imagined. Thus, he and I visited sporadically together, but often in those days of natural ranch workaday rhythms. Mostly he hurriedly, desperately even, was planting the high ground of his fields, for spring had brought too much rain. Still, in the second week of June, he was getting stuck in the low ground. Time for planting almost run out. An early frost surely would kill the immature grain. Early rising, long hours, feeding animals, little time for food himself, climbing down from a farm rig well after dark, the occasional 40-mile trip to town for machine parts when the great hungry mechanical creatures break down. End of the day, stark human weariness. After one such long day, we were about to sit down to an 8 p.m. supper when the phone rang, a neighbor. Our cattle were out, and they were in the neighbor's field. Three more concerned phone calls came before we had grabbed jackets and flown out the door. 4 miles later, in our red Ford pickup, bouncing across a wide pasture, its grasses more high than our running boards, we found the elusive few cows, one trailed by a tiny calf. Patiently, we walked them a mile or so back to the herd, Lars on foot, me in the pickup, each of us along a side of the poorly strung barbed wire fence line to a lowered wire gate where we drove them through. Then we hunted for their escape spot. Finding it near the skeletal corral remains of remembered cattle roundups, brandings, and castrations, we wordlessly began to mend the fence. Wire cutters, pliers, extra pieces of barbed wire fencing from the truck, pulling up the sagging square-patterned wire fence that was braided into the long grasses at the bottom. I knew this work. For a quick moment, as I glanced over at him, my brother's face became my father's, his voice, my father's voice. And I relived the rush of pleasure I felt that came with the rare praise that might come my way from my dad when I was 18 and his only ranch hand. Silently, Lars and I fenced, patching the great space between barbs that could let a grown creature through. Rusty staples removed from the weathered wooden fence posts, then replaced anew on the barbed wire into the same posts, the tap-tap of the hammer in the evening silence. Wire clips attaching the stretched barbed wire over the steel posts. No gloves. Cows in the distance chewed and watched us. The summer sun went down, blood red along the vast horizon. I drove us home over the grass lying down track made by our arrival to the remote place, my brother a passenger. He was silently smoking his last cigarette. In 3 days, he turns 50, and he has promised his wife and kids to stop smoking. We had spoken rarely, but I could tell my brother, too, reluctantly recognized that I knew this work deep in my bones, that this was my place, that in this moment on the planet, oh so briefly, I was at home. I left next day for my life back at a college in Minnesota. We hugged goodbye. Neither of us could talk, nor could we have answered anyone why our hearts were spilling over. A little more along that theme. I have lived now in Minnesota a long, long time, but I can't get away from being a South Dakota woman. And I'm sure that that will probably be true all of my life. This poem is called Cut. I love original earth like the pasture at home in Dakota that's never been plowed. Its curves reveal the circular shadows of Indian encampments and pask flowers, faint, feathery blue, with saffron stamens reaching like feelers. I remember my Mustang's hooves crushing them. Yet the pasks return spring after spring after spring. They push up baked clay still tied to the earth's apron. Each year since then, the land's curves harbor pheasant nest secrets, the broken shells of my memory of mowing the blowing grasses. How in the last round I would leap off the tractor to run through the narrow swath of still-standing brome and chase out the small furred and feathered before finally thrusting the sickle through. Dad wondered what always took me so long on that last round, and I never told him. I wish I had, but I had not yet learned what we had in common, the prairie in our veins like blood. Maybe if we had each sliced a wrist and held them tightly to each other, both of us would have been more grounded. maybe everything else would have been different. And this is a description of the house. I was sitting at home one Easter a couple of years ago, just looking around at this large house that's on Sand Lake that was built the year that my father was 1 year old. And thought how amazing it was. I hadn't known it when I was young and small there. This is called The Heart of the Matter. This house, raised against all odds on the east side of Sand Lake in South Dakota, 1908, rebuilt itself in my heart. In the years after I was 20, I moved fast, moved 8 different places in fewer years, unaware that the builders had already been contracted and were at work on a monumental task in my heart space, oak banisters and all. 17 individually carved dowels to the landing, 27 more to the second floor, the bottom pillar with a loose lid where kids dropped a German oak nutcracker one holiday and we didn't tell. He lay there for years. Later, I searched for him with a flashlight, but he had gone, and I do not know his rescuer. It's my sister. No other truly grand houses line Sand Lake, the kind with carved lintels above each downstairs window and sliding oak doors between the two largest rooms. But even such a house could not save Grandma Herseth from herself. Her own dark interior, as Grandpa's large laugh resounded through its rooms after he had bet on horses or drunk himself into stupor in the distant towns. This house's attic, in my heart, allows such a view of distance that to this day, hills or too many tall trees closet me. Each spring, the pull on my body home foreshadows the day my heart falls down, the great-grandfather clock finally quiet in the heart's room. A refinished bookcase held cattle medicine in my young dad helping days, and the dining room still contains the carved table, buffet, and 8 chairs that my mother bought for $74.88 when she was very young, before her marriage even. My luck to be brought to this house in 1940, a newborn. I know its intimacies, every depth of corner. I can move in its dark without sound, my hand finding light switches or landing places before my head does. The women who come to this house to live with the men who own it do not know their way here as my sister and I do. And we banished resent those who later offer civilly to please feel at home. All the rest of the years that they live in this house, they will never carry its great weight in such a small place as a heart. And this poem was an assignment which really frightened me. My mother had a big Buntrock reunion coming up, and she wanted me to write a poem for it. And I am not an occasional poem writer. I wait desperately, hoping that some inspiration will come anytime I'm writing, and I can't call it up. But she told me 1.5 years in advance, and so I... So I had some time, and I actually wrote this poem here at Holden, sitting over there in Chalet 1. Home Place. The shore of Sandy Lake abuts the edge of my memory close like the much-loved land. Some of us, mostly daughters, move away, but the feel of earth between our toes, sun hot above grain spun to gold, chaff and itch beneath our shirts, sweat, and the brief cool reprieve of a reluctant rain washing through the cracks of western window panes on the old home place remain vivid. As if being young there had just happened, and our mother, seated in the shade of an elm shelling trees, lifts her head at our father's call from his pickup truck window to come check cattle at the Dacre place. The shore of a sandy lake weaves along the reed-slim edge of my memory like the haunting land. Each autumn I hear calves bawling, and the calling geese, blues, and snows fall from grace in that season. Years gather like fleet clouds on the horizon of the home place. And one more of that kind of thing. This is called Horse. I rode a lot of horses when I was young, but nobody really taught me the proper ways to ride. I just did it with... And actually, the one horse accident I had where a horse went over backwards on me was because I didn't know the proper ways of riding a horse, and that one had been trained that way. This is called Horse. From 24 December to January 24, each day hangs opaquely toward the earth. A horse from the past steps out of a foggy landscape as I drive to the cities, calling on the memory of horse. Bessie, Grey Lady, Danderee, the black one I never named. I remember the spirited sound, the hooves, the ice trip on this road to the airport at my father's dying, the dark, snaking, hearse-led line of cars through snow. The creature horse in my head, our source and connected skin, a deep memory, language resonating from the withers. That black horse, carrier of more than spirit but nothing less, lived briefly on the land of my youth. My brother found it dead in a corn stubble field, kept from food by the others. 15 years later, I know it as a sign. Horse power, round of belly, great in shoulder, aging, I have come to look like horse. It has little to do with the fast way out. Already I have lived long at the edge, neither in nor out of town. My piece of grass too small for horse or self. Once, many horses, Angus too, ran in my father's fields. I thought my inheritance contained them. Then I married, traveled, birthed babies, and learned that I left more than horse behind. A pinto appears on the skyline. Its black-white arrangement of skin moves close to the freeway. I leave the car, but it will not come, won't put its nostrils and remembered breath into my palm. But someday the lost, unnamed one will reappear and prophesy. Till then I search the winter prairie, the roadways, and far pastures. This is a book called The Book of Hearts, which was one of the nominees for Minnesota Book Award in 1994. And has meant a lot to me because the first 10 poems in there are about our daughter and David's and my discovery and parenting of her. But I'm going to jump to this one. This is a new book, and there are 10 of us in the writing group that I'm part of, and we have met together, not the same, all the same members, but we've met together for more than 20 years, every week, except in summers. And we don't know exactly when we started. It was somewhere back in the late 60s or early 70s when there were not very many creative writers in the English department at St. Olaf. But a friend of mine and I were the outlaws. One of the reasons I write, I think, is to catch moments that go by and that I wouldn't think about again if I hadn't caught them down with words. And so sometimes they're short. I think of them as oriental almost. They're just caught moments in time that I want to remember. This one is called Anniversary 1993, and I wrote this when I was sitting up on the swing at another chalet in the summer that we were here. And David and I do have an anniversary on the 6th of June, and this came out of that. Somewhere on a trail he is running. I wait in a perfume of white lilacs on this listless swing. Somewhere in Minnesota my daughter is crying. I hear her far off beyond mountains, beyond sunrise. This one is called Cyclist. The cyclist in this story was John Mockestead, if some of you know who he is. He's a painter, and he's contributed a lot to this village. Lives in Northfield. And one morning I went out to get the mail in my bathrobe and ran into him, but I didn't know it was him because I couldn't see him. He was in the sun like this, so his face was blanked out. I didn't know it was John. You look beautiful in the morning. The cyclist's voice, low slung across the road, wrapped itself around me, cold, dressed in my copper velvet robe in the summer's early climbing sun. I looked east, but the sun blanked out his face. Only the blurry outline of a bearded man pressed upon me that he might have meant what he had said. Still, he is probably the kind of man who raptures flute-playing women are extremely sensuous, but he's too intent on his desperate quest to stop cycling. This one is also a Holden poem. This was written for Allison on her 24th birthday, I think. We were here at Holden, and we were hiking with her and Dolores up to the Copper Basin. And she and Dolores had a relationship for quite a long time that ended more because of the age difference than lack of love for each other. This is called Birthday Remembrance. We hike together, you, your father, your love, and I. We climb for hours to a high valley basin. We watch you kiss beneath ancient pine, and in the distance a fall of water, a windy, soughing refrain. We lean a minute for steadiness into this mountain, eat hummus and oranges on a scree of rock. Pungent orange oils the pads of our fingers, tinges everything. My eyes follow the spine of Martin Ridge. A marmot whistles. You two decide to stake no claim on the other for now. Far beneath us, the valley meanders east, then west, harboring debris from the heart's deep mine. We wonder aloud at the human hunger that can carve into stone, haul ore from earth's belly, leave a gaping hollowness behind. Our own bones lighten in the moment. We lean on our walking staffs and descend. Later in lapidary, we grind chosen stones into cabochons, leave them as gifts in the hand of the other. Moss agate, amethyst, rainbow obsidian, hard beauty formed in fire and loss eons ago. And another poem written for Mother's Day after my mother was gone from a photograph of Mother sitting with the three of us as young children around her, and we're all dressed in little cowboy outfits. Mother's Day 1995. In the family photo taken in 1951, all our faces are unlined, pure beyond imagining. Hers too. What was ahead was still ahead. The political life of many losses, some victories. The intimate life that eluded her. Our trip to Ireland in 1965. My impatient rudeness to her 30 years later when I shoveled gravel in the yard of her new white clapboard house on the Missouri just weeks before her death. We two little girls in our cowgirl hats and western shirts with fringe in the photograph move toward adolescence with nonchalance. Although Connie leans her weight a little bit into Mom's akimbo arm, and our five-year-old brother, his pants pockets shaped like holsters, stares with clear eyes into the distance as if he already knows about future fierce things. Two of the three of us fold our hands. Maybe Mother does too, although today, staring at this picture, I cannot tell. She always held them carefully in photographs so that her ruined fingers caught and pulled away from her when she was 1 year old while hay binding with her brothers wouldn't show. Her thumb rests lightly on Lars's little arm. She loved that son. Us too, I know, but there was something different in her love for him. And in the morning that she left us all, they were alone together, the two of them, in an upper room at the farm. In the photo, I am thin. The hips that were to come and cradle my own three within the womb are still unformed. In all our gazes, no hint of the parenthood yet to come that shows in hers. Mom wears a little hat, the 50s choker, necklace, earrings, and although the photograph is black and white, I know the color of her dress, rust brown. It's long and slim, long-sleeved, and when she stands at her knees, it flounces out. The color of the shirts we children wear, I can't recall. I do not lean. My hands hang lightly at my sides, but notice my 11-year-old lips are tense. What lies ahead is still ahead. And then I'd like to read a couple of poems that other people have written in here. I have especially a friend who's been writing about having a new babe in her life. And her poetry is especially meaningful to me because I wasn't a writer at the time that my children were babies. And It was having them all at home that drove me to writing. But when they were small ones, I wasn't yet doing it. So this is written by a woman named Siggy Leonhard, who is a German teacher at Carleton. And her writing about this new child is very moving to me. This is called Like One Body. When she needs me at night, I run to her room barefoot, my eyes half closed. At 2 a.m., I pick her up. She wraps her legs around me, knows my waist and how to ride, my hips. She knows that I will pick her up, will carry her to my room, to my bed, will slide with her down onto the pillow when she needs me late at night. She knows. And in the corridor already, she stops crying and puts her head into the space between my shoulder and my neck. I, under the stern eye of the moon, carry her, eyes half closed and barefoot, and whisper, "We are going now to bed, to sleep, to dream together." At 2, at 3, at 4 a.m., I never put her down. We sink onto the pillows like one body, and already she is back asleep, and I lie grateful for a while. Then she sleeps easily at 2 and 3 and 4 a.m. and breathes warmth into my bed and peace and sweetness when she needs me late at night. And then this child grows up a little bit. This is called The Fit. Her father calls it demented rage. She hurls herself onto the floor as I pull the garbage can out of her hands and the potato peels which she is determined to eat. I call it a bad day because she woke up early from her nap. But my words drown in a high-pitched fury of screams. I never knew of a scream that could scrape your eardrums. Her father tries to enunciate the firm but not uncaring no that is supposed to set boundaries. I hold her with my arms stretched out so she can't hit me or herself. If it isn't one thing, it's another. I see her point only too well. We are no fun. We shove ourselves between her and the world. No to hitting the cat. No to the interesting food in the garbage can. No to the smooth mirror of water in the toilet bowl in which you can rinse Dad's toothbrush. No to eating the cat food. She calms down. She has seen Mom's engagement calendar under the high chair, and she hurries to get it before the next no. Like a dilettante thief, she runs into her favorite corner, opens it, looks at the pages with an earnest face, and gets to work. We look at each other and pretend we haven't noticed. During a blissfully quiet half hour with a cup of coffee in the Sunday paper for us, she rips out a few pages of March, then of August, and she hides them under the frying pan. And one more. This is another one about a house. This is written by my friend Marcella Taylor, who is a Bahamian. She's a really interesting woman who has moved and moved and moved, and I have never known really where to call her home. And then one time she had this great apartment, and I was so glad that Marcella had this wonderful apartment, and the next thing I knew she had sold it. And then here's this poem about why she did, and it's really interesting to me. It's called Resuming the Journey, and this is Marcella. I loved sitting there at only a slight distance from the slender bay windows, the huge elm tree outside brushing against brownstone walls. Moses, the middle cat, would perch on the window seat watching squirrels and birds in a rare moment of contentment. I made a space inside me for that shelter, its elegant white walls, spotless marble fixtures, high ceilings, gallery lights. I liked its flow of open space, the sun entering and traveling from one corner to another unimpeded. The cats rolled across carpets together, forming dual and triple bonds. At times I felt I was the outsider, even there. I let those light-filled rooms in, but I kept myself out, wandering from day to day as if in a convoluted tunnel, waiting for a point of arrival. I wrote in my journal, I will make these spaces my own when I discard alien alliances, the only fruit of a beleaguered life. This place that touched my being, I could not own, for I did not own myself. I sold it to a couple who would divide their time between this city place and a river house, who in that division would weld body and space. I packed the furniture, which fit only with great unease, into other rooms and bundled the cats into carriers without bars. We started on our way, moving from place to place, their sustainment, the familiar smells of each other, mine, only the journey itself. And one more from her. This is called Flowers for Charlie. It's a fairly short, quick one. All in girlish white, I sat stiffly at a table in the bar, not sure what to order. You smiled, a handsome glint in your blue eyes, ready to follow my lead. The other two settled for beers. We dared the cocktail. You were my first college date, and I was too young. Why am I remembering you tonight, decades later? Is it the figure of my silence, the awkwardness of my feet, the fear of showing how proud I felt to have been matched with the catch of the college town? The hall was a film of floating shadow, the music silenced after our second dance. Our midnight goodbyes at the convent dorm, tentative. You were off to the army. And only now, with all the miles between this room and the men I still love, am I wondering if you made it back alive? And Mary Easter, who's a dancer at Carleton, has the piece for which the title comes. So I'll end with that one. This is called If I Said. If I said whatever I wanted to say, it would come out in one long howl that the world doesn't give me what I want when I want it. A long screeching howl from deep in the throat, moving up to the echo in the back of my head from all the cavities of my skull. If I said what I want, it would not be responsible, nor accepting, not patient and mature, but urgent and full of insistence. Hear my howl right now and know its meaning in the part of you that would howl too if it could say whatever it wanted. The howling voice says, don't keep turning away. Stop hiding. Come out from behind your wall. Skip over the beginning and start in the middle of hot emotion, protest, anger, need, hurt, disappointment. The howling voice sets off tremors, vibrations enough to rearrange the world. Capture all awareness, put its priorities first. Snap the population to attention. Surround me, confront me, know me, and let me know you back. So that is a taste of the new publication. Then I'm going to shift a little bit to some of the writing that I've done because of Allison, this wonderful presence in our life. I think everything that David and I needed to learn was not in kindergarten, it was having these children. We didn't know what we didn't know when we were in kindergarten. This is another poem written here at Holden. David and I have spent quite a bit of time here at different points in our life. This was when Allison was 8 years old, and it's been interesting to have written about these children and then discover things and look back and find out how prescient it was. Allison herself can hardly believe it. This was just a poem written because we'd had an argument, a kind of mother-daughter spat that made me feel bad. But the great gift from this poem is that in her second year at St. Olaf, she wrote a song in answer to it. Mm-hmm. And invited David and me up to a student coffee house where we were the only non-students and sang her answer back, which was pretty wonderful. And I have her words. I can't sing, so I can't do that for you, but at some point I will answer this poem with what she wrote. This is called Before Language. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me, and I would like to talk to you in the language of women easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong. My humor like a tune off key, not well received in your ear or your heart. But I promise I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time when in the womb strumming the same chord, we needed no words. Changeling. You arrive running, all bone and sinew, and on every photo after one sock wrinkles down. Later word comes from Lesbos that you are here only for a visit. I had thought you mine, that I could own you in my image. But you insist and show me that wonderful mind of your own, revealing the riblocked secret, your becoming self, coming fast before my very heart. I notice heart appears a lot in my work. I don't remember when I first knew of the wild gene loose in our family, but dressed in fringed leather, I stalked it all of my youth from the back of a horse and avoided men till one unlike the others came and stopped my quest. I saw it first, though, in a farm-bred aunt who left the farm by bus to teach from coast to coast. Always on the move, she kept open invitation wherever she lived for those who didn't fit. Then a nephew, drawn at 10 to the religion his mother left to marry a Lutheran, sought a monastery education like a moth finds flame. And you came, adept at math and music and secrets. I am surprised it took me so long to recognize your gait when at age 1 you careened down the hall of our first home, marked even then with the wild gene. This one is called Ermine, and this was put together in two snippets of time. Allison once came home from school when she was in about third grade and said to me, "Mom, have you ever not known how to be, even when you're with your friends?" And I just thought, you know, growing up, difficult kinds of times, 8 years old, pre-adolescent. Later I've thought about it maybe a little differently. Then also at another time, she was out in our backyard and had watched a weasel that was turning white for winter, so it was half white and half brown. And in this poem, these two instances that actually happened quite a ways apart come together. And this is called Ermine. A tall girl in large glasses perches immobile on a log near a creek. Her rounded shoulders hunch against the nameless future. Her lips move, but she makes no sound. Her shadow steals away in the twilight. Nearby, a small, wary weasel stares at her from beneath the roots of a fallen elm, its head white against winter, body still soft brown. It watches the girl, the creek flows, light fades, and neither move. When the snows come, it will have a new name. She wonders, between the brown time and the white time, does an ermine ever not know how to be, even with its friends? Will she ever know the safety of the new season, a new name? How to say? I do not know how to say this. You are not what I expected. Your father and I came together at a particular moment in our knowing, and from deep inside me you already were, made in the image of the great God who loves you even more than I do, and that's saying something. Made in my image too, of course, and your father's, those young years when you looked like him, the tomboy ones when you walked like me, and now a woman on course among careless teachings and wrong-headed ones, you make your way. All the time reaching a hand back to me. I will keep up, but I'm not as young as you, nor as urgent. But I am coming, dear heart, don't get out of sight. I am coming, and I will bring others. And I did a reading at St. Olaf, and she came in late. She's usually late to most things. The poetry reading. She comes late, sits at my feet before the 10 readers and our audience, comes to hear our instruments of voice, cadences of words, truth hanging in the air. Her hand on my boot is warm. She leans this daughter heat into my thigh, a summer child sprung from my forehead like Athena from Zeus, her baseball cap already firmly on backwards. She sees differently fundamental things like music, math, love, possibility, and the uncharted routes of escape. And then sometimes I get kind of pedantic and want to talk straight to the straight culture. And this is a poem called Bringing Up Parents. You young parent in the city park with your brown eyes following that child on the jungle gym, think of it. She may be a baby dyke, the photos in her baby book revealing forever what you cannot yet name. Or you with those costumes and then lives in them, adopts another name for weeks at a time, insists on velvet, sometimes lace. Or the two of you, much decorated Navy captain and city librarian wife, with the ramrod young man taking home all the honors in his class at West Point, yet he seldom writes home. Holds his secret so tightly to his chest, if he held out his hands, he might fly straight off the planet. So straight-laced this culture. Narrow, no room for a gay heart to spread wings and soar. Damage done early. Parents of gay children, throw off that embarrassment. Send with pride the family Christmas photograph with your daughter holding her beloved's hand. New breed of pioneers. Their child, much loved grandbaby, cavorting between them. Two wonderful mamas taking their urgent time bringing us all up. And I've done a couple of others that are a little more recent. One I wrote Christmas Eve after our Christmas Eve service at Church in Northfield, and this one was written in direct answer to Leviticus. Whereby one of the other sins that's listed in Leviticus is to not wear clothes of mixed fibers. On December 24th, for the first time in a long while, I went to church. As I remembered, the children were there, all the red-robed children. I sat in a long pew with my family from South Dakota, brother, mom, husband, my own three. And filled with much emotion, I watched those red-robed children, remembering mine, young, at successive ages, wearing all the colors of choir robes that our church offers its children. Less naive now, I have learned that not all folks in churches wish our children well. Some children are not good enough, according to their book of literal scripture 1 and 2. They are not spiritual enough for God's grace. The ancient purification rites, where one admonishes us not to wear fabrics of mixed fibers, and there they are, all those choir children in their polyester colors, singing their hearts out like mine did year after year, taking for granted congregational loyalty support, which often is yanked out from under them so fast their head spins if one of those singing cherubs has a sexuality reserved only for a few. Whereby if they grow up and give away their heart to one of their own, whereby if they unabashedly love and ask for home congregation's same blessing that their brothers and sisters automatically get. Anyway, on December 24, I was in a familiar pew with familiar serious-faced children, family even, singing the familiar Christmas verses about a baby in Bethlehem, a cold, dark world, and no room. And I knew better than ever what those verses were all about. I am afraid for my child. I keep much in my heart. And this one is one written recently for Philip Knudsen, who is a friend of our family, a staff member in the Office of Higher Education in Chicago on Higgins Road, who was gay and kept it a secret most of his life, although at the end, when he was dying of AIDS, he came to St. Olaf and gave a talk and gave much money for panels and education study to happen. I have to push somebody there because I haven't heard much happening lately about that. But I had sent him a book of my poems at one point and got a letter back. And this is a poem that I guess my poetry is what I'm thinking about and what I'm chewing on and the things that bother me and trouble me and that I wish were different, and this is certainly one of them. And there's a word in here you might not know the meaning of. It's airy, and I end it with it, and that is a place of safety for eagles, a nesting place, a home for eagles, the airy. This is called Sanctuary for you, Philip Knudsen. Something huge happened today. My pen trailing my mind cannot track it. I have your card in your handwriting in my hand. Ink barely a week old on the page. A few days after writing me, you invited your family home for the weekend, walked out to your garage in Chicago on a Sunday morning, the church hour, and ended your life. I have begun to catch on. You had finally opened the box of your heart and freed the secret that should not have had to have been a secret to the elderly aunts, your sister, a brother, nephews, parents, and the church to whom you had given your life of work, and to the rest of us, who instead should have held you up like a raptor with a finely healed wing, spirit bird with a message, loose and free into the universe. That part you did yourself. Now God provides the airy. And this one is called Urgency. I'm not as graceful about some of these things as Dan Spencer is, and I think it's because the protectiveness of a parent over the rights and justices and life of their children is pretty profound. And I'm aware of that. These poems are not subtle. This is called Urgency. We do not have time to spare, no time for lengthy discussions that might lead to justice in the future. The time is now. People's lives are being led at this very moment behind closed doors of opportunity, lived on your street and mine, doors that turn homosexuals into shadows of their possible selves. And we in the larger culture turn away smugly saying, not yet, can't move too fast, things are changing, I've seen it. Notice how much there's more of this in the newspaper these days? Yep, we're getting there, we're making progress. Not fast enough for me, for my daughter, for her dreams of possibility. She is soon past 30, and you know as well as I, you're the one who always says, if you're not on your way to solidarity by 30, then when? Unlike you, she does not have the luxury of time for your reasonable panels of talk, your conferences, your opinion papers, and the politician's pretense of insight and wisdom. She needs respect, contracts, promises. She needs them now. Soon is very much too late. And then my last not subtle one. This is called Don't Get It. I don't get why Christians don't get it. They spend so much time dividing people into sheep and goats when God all along has said, I, thy God, will do that. Lo, observe my son who goes around Palestine tipping things upside down, pushing down tabernacles, visiting Samaritan wells, and making promises to prostitutes, even distributing wine in Cana. Christians talk the talk about Christ as best example and how to live. Then they ignore his deeds, all those miracles, even as they read the words and the stories and the parables out loud from the pulpits and church schools all over the land. I don't get it. I don't get why Christians don't get it. And let's see, I promised to go back to Allison's answer. So first I'll read that first poem and then her answer and a final poem. So this is the language one again. Daughter, sometimes I know your eyes follow me and I would like to talk to you in the language of women easy in each other's company. So often when I try, the words are wrong. My humor like a tune off key, not well received in your ear or your heart. But I promise I will wait for a day when we reach the same language, the sounds deep in our memories of another time when in the womb, strumming the same chord, we needed no words. Mama, you once wrote a poem for me at a time when I was young and angry. I didn't want to hear your words. Mama, you said you'd wait for me, for a time when we could share a common language, two women, two voices, one shared music, one dance on common ground. Mama, my vision's not the same as yours. I think I've always known it, still it comes as some surprise, for Mama, you're so much a part of me. I looked away for years. My independence didn't want to see the kindred soul I recognize now, reflecting in your eyes. Well, Mama, it's been a long, long time coming. I had to climb this rugged path alone. I'll never know how hard it was to watch me run away from you, but Mama, won't you smile with me? Today, this different daughter is heading home. Mama, I wrote this song for you at a time when I'm just learning how to put my feelings into words. Mama, thank you for waiting for me. My language has an unexpected accent, but our voices still are harmony. Two women dancing, dancing on common ground. Well, Mama, it's been a long, long time coming. I had to climb this rugged path alone. I'll never know how hard it was to watch me run away from you. But Mama, won't you smile with me? Today, this different daughter is heading home. And then the very last poem is called Coming Out. And this was really fun because I had a lunch hour at St. Olaf where I, in the fall, and we have a lot of blooming apple trees along this little road that I take to go home, but it was fall, and I couldn't understand there were blooms on the limbs, not very many, but some. And I remembered that we'd had an early spring, and I don't know enough about apple trees to know that this would happen, but these trees, all of them, they were blooming in the fall. And I started writing in the car. I had a pen and pencil down here in the middle, and I was writing this poem, Coming Out. All over town, crabapple trees have come out blooming in the wrong season, the wrong climate. People have noticed, yet no one can account for it. Some have begun to consult the specialists. And others hold that an early frost last spring set these trees on a different course. But in any event, it is nature, true nature at her surprisingest. The way I see it, the only thing to do is sit back, enjoy, or get out of the way of their blooming in our front yards and along the roadways and in the far distance. But I urge you to stop long enough to attend closely their beauty, the fragileness of flower, study the blooms, the tight buds, the leaves coming out all around us, as most other Midwestern trees turn gray. Thank you.